Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to episode 16 of the Husky International series and a long interview with German alpinist David Göttler. I met up with David when he came to Stockholm for a lecture as a part of the release of The Other Way, a brand new summit series from the North Face. My name is Magnus Ormestad and this is the Swedish outdoor podcast Husky. Find out more about this episode and previous episodes at huskypodcast.com. This episode was made in cooperation with Ad Nature and the North Face. I also came in contact with some of the people in the US behind the design process of The Other Way.
You guys there?
Yes, we are.
And we did a short interview.
Yeah, I'm Joe Vernaccio. I'm the Global Vice President of Product at the North Face.
So could you tell me a bit, what is the Summit series from the North Face? What's the background story behind that?
Yeah, the Summit series is a group of products that we specifically label with Summit series on it. That is to be our best in class mountaineering kit. It's something that the brand started in 2000, the year 2000, and it's continued to evolve ever since. And it's kind of become a statement in the marketplace as the best and illustrates what's possible to make.
And now for this season, you launched the Summit series. Well, kind of a special edition of the Summit series, if I understood it correctly. That's called The Other Way. So, what's the story behind that, and what's the story behind the name?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. One was internally, just with us as a product team and a brand. Summit series over those 15 years or so continued to evolve and broaden and get much larger than just this premier mountaineering kit. So we decided we'd take the risk to edit it down and get back to just that premium kit. At the same time, as we were looking at that, we had ways of manufacturing and ways of making product that we wanted to try and we thought could really elevate the product and what was possible. So we use Summit Series as our think tank to evolve what's possible in both manufacturing, in design, but also how we meet the athlete's needs to try to make, you know, garments that are incredibly warm, incredibly durable in the most progressive, advanced ways possible. So that was kind of the foundation of the reset. One was to bring it back down to a mountaineer's kit and to use it as our laboratory for our best thinking. In our design process, we kept trying to choose the more difficult route. So trying to make some analogy to climbing a mountain that had been climbed many, many times, but how do we take the more elegant line and the more interesting way up the mountain? We decided when we got to a design problem, we kept saying to ourselves, well, let's go the other way and see where we get to. And that just happened to be coincidentally similar or very almost identical to what Conrad says. We have a quote from Conrad where he was saying, you know, some people decide to go become accountants, and I just decided to go the other way and become a mountaineer for a living. And both us seeing it in writing from Conrad and us realizing that we've said that through the entire design process, we thought that that was just the right thing to kind of give ourselves something to hold on to for this season.
When designing a series like this one, like The Other Way, how does it work? Like, where do you get the most important, the most valuable input from for the design team?
Yeah, it all started with the athletes. It started very simply with just a big group of our athletes getting together in Boulder, having dinner, opening up a few bottles of wine, and talking. They all brought garments that they liked, things that they didn't like, both whether it be our products or other companies' products. And the process kind of started from there, from just a simple dinner. That was part of the spark and part of the inspiration behind even this idea of editing it back down to just the essentials and just what the athletes needed. And then from there, we worked certainly with Conrad. Conrad Anker was instrumental in this project from the very beginning and went all the way through to the final testing expedition that we sent people on. So it always starts and ends with our athletes. Many of our designers are athletes themselves, and they get out there with them. There's not that much translation required. It's simply just reminding ourselves what those things are that people need.
But during this process, could you get like a phone call from Conrad or someone like calling from Burma, like screaming at you, like remove the Velcro from the this and this layer and blah blah blah? Or do you have like a structure with regular meetings during the year and during the process? Or
A little bit of both. There's definitely, set touch points where we'll get together to make sure every last detail is considered. But we did get such a phone call where Conrad called and said, "You've got to take the gaiters out of this pant. I'm tired of these big, wide pants that everybody forces me to use. And in ice climbing, I want to be able to see my feet, and I want you to take these gaiters out. These aren't ski pants, these are mountaineering pants, and I don't need gaiters." And we took them out, and it makes the pant a lot less commercial in broad use, so harder to ski in and harder to ski mountaineer in because you don't have that gaiter, but it's excellent for ice climbing,
and that's really the next question, if it's sometimes difficult or perhaps even impossible, because you are a commercial company, and if it's difficult to kind of translate this, because the needs of the people like Göttler and Conrad Anker, they are highly skilled, like very kind of narrow professionals, and their demands and their thoughts about equipment, is it difficult to translate that into something that will like speak to the normal end customers and attract the masses kind of?
Yeah, I mean, there are parts of our line where we do need to do that translation. This was not the place for us to do that. This was the place for us to purely express what that pinnacle mountaineer alpinist needs and put it in our line with no dilution and no editing. So this was the place for us to do that. We weren't we're not measuring our success or failure based upon how many units we sell. We're measuring our success based upon comments we are getting from mountaineers who are actually using the product on the mountain.
And looking at this the other way, how long does a design process like that take? Is it possible to answer that? I mean, does it have a certain like starting date and end date?
Well, we started this project of kind of relaunching Summit in the very end of 2013 with the initial thoughts of what it was we were going to do. And then we still had the 2014 line in play. So that one continued. But while that one was being designed and developed, we created a little Skunkworks team that went off to the side and started on the 2015 product, so a full 2 years in advance of the launch of it. And a lot of that time went into what was possible and what were the fundamental problems that people, mountaineers, needed to solve and how could we solve them with advanced manufacturing techniques fairly straightforward, simple concepts, but very elaborate in how we had to actually solve those problems.
And finally, you've already touched upon that, but the designers, the team working on these products, how active are those people outside of office hours?
Quite active. Most of the people on our very technical climbing, skiing, and running gear are all highly, highly active. Whether it's the people working on our running gear, they're all running 50-mile trail runs and 100-mile UTMBs. If in our equipment team, they're out. The team was out just this weekend, all ice climbing up in the Sierras. And they do it as a team, and they do it without any prompting. They're very happy to go out and quote unquote test product. So, and then the same for this team. Going forward, a lot of the members of the Summit product team actually live in Boulder, Colorado, where we have a small design studio there. So they have access to the Rockies on a regular basis.
Don't miss a short comment from Ad Nature after the interview.
What were you like when you were a kid?
What I was like when I was a kid? Well, I think I was pretty normal, average kid. I didn't have any kind of eccentric phase in my life, I think so. But there's always, like I said it about myself, so if you ask my parents, maybe they say
he was crazy.
Something different. But yeah, I mean, I discovered this kind of life of being outside and pretty early, I think, for me, and it was kind of hooked. My father introduced me to climbing and mountaineering when I was around 7, so pretty early.
But that comes in the family. Your family, your father and your mother, they were very active people, outdoors people.
Yeah, definitely my father, and my mother was more kind of a... did it a mellow way, so she was hiking a lot, and what both showed me was adventure traveling. So from the, I mean, I can't imagine or remember one holiday we did like a normal in a Robinson Club or whatever. So we always went with a Jeep or four-wheel drive car, and we went through the middle of Africa, so the Sahara, so the Hoggar Mountains, I think, when I was, I don't know, I must be something like 10 or 11, and I have one sister who's 2 years younger. So we went there, and we went 3 times to Iceland with their own car, like with the ferry from, I don't know, it was Amsterdam or Hamburg or whatever. And then, I don't know, 5-6 days ferry up there. And then the whole summer holidays, like 5 weeks, we drove around there with their own car. And so I think, yeah, they showed me both this kind of adventure life, and I was hooked. My sister wasn't hooked at all, for example. She went totally in a different direction. We have a good relationship, but we are totally different. So, and I stayed on that track, and I finished high school, and after that I started my mountain guide education and become a mountain guide and started my professional mountaineering career.
But you never dreamt of, because the next question would be if you dreamt of adventures as a kid, but you were out on adventures, on proper adventures. Did you dream of like going on an easy vacation to Mallorca, or did you dream of like, wow, the big old expeditions to Antarctica or Mount Everest or whatever? Did you have those kind of dreams or?
Definitely the last one you mentioned. I think I can remember that I dreamt at all going to...
I want to go to London and my own resorts.
Yeah, something like that. No, never. And never. Some, also, beach holiday was always something kind of... Oh, I was kind of scared of that. And we went always once a year, only with my mother. I remember to the North Sea, to Spica Rock. It's a really tiny island there without cars. But that was, again, I mean, that was on the sea, but it was... We could stroll around on this whole small island because it was so small, we can just go on our own when we were kids. So it was, again, really full-on adventure for us. So, yeah, I grew up in Munich, and we made our own kind of small raft and went down like this tiny river which we had like close by and ran a little bit through Munich and things like that. So I always like to do that things. And so that was my start as an adventurer and a mountaineer.
But were you or are you still interested in those, what I said, like the old adventures, like the old big ones, the old first ascents and first discoveries of continents and mountains? And
well, I'm interested in, on the one side, like reading of it. Of course, I like to read the stories, and the best and most motivating book for me on expedition is always reading about Shackleton and these guys, and because they
The best commander on an expedition.
Yeah, and also like the way, but I was always way more fascinated of the way they kind of suffer and they can stay there for this, I mean, almost for a year on this island and just waiting, because that's what you do on expedition so most, you have this waiting game. And so when I read these things, I always think like, oh my God, we are so whiny here. And just after 1 week of bad weather, we kind of, oh, come on, weather's changing and we want to go home. And so you read these books, you think, look at these guys. I mean, they stayed like for a year. They didn't have any kind of, you know, satellite phone or whatever. They even didn't know if they get rescued at all. And they just waited. And so I like these kind of aspects of kind of, you know, this endurance and this kind of, you know, they just, yeah, they believed in it and they stayed and they waited and they just tried again and again. How often these guys went back there and tried it again to reach the south and north pole is crazy. So, and that's what I find really super interesting on this old adventures. And for me, my adventures, for sure, they're different. And nowadays, I think they become different in general, which don't make them any more enjoyable or exciting. Or I don't wish that I would have been born in this decade. I'm super happy to live now and here, and I think out there are so many adventures waiting for me, so I can't complain. And
I heard a quote, I don't know if I remember it correctly, but like back in the old days, speaking of the old expeditions, that back in the old days the boats were made of wood and the men were made of steel. These days the boats are made of plastic and the men are made of Gore-Tex.
That's right, probably. That's a good quote. That's what we are surrounded of, like Gore-Tex and synthetic and high tech. I mean, it's crazy nowadays what we have with us on this. Yeah. Adventures
and if you look at the clothes and the equipment that they had, like, I don't know, only 50 years ago or 100 years ago, it's amazing to see what they accomplished.
No, definitely. When I compare to the in the Himalayas, because that's my field more or less, like the high alpine mountaineering or climbing, and I see 50 years ago what the closest the equipment looked like, it's sometimes hard to imagine that they survived or that they did what they did. It's crazy.
You said that you became a mountain guide after high school, but you never had a normal job career or plans of a quote-unquote normal job career.
No, not that I had the plan, but I also didn't have the plan to become a mountain guide. So when I finished my high school in Germany, we have to do this 1 year of social work.
Oh, yeah. The military
time.
Service or the social?
Yeah, you can choose, and I choose the social work. And I went to a place outside of Munich, like an hour, and in the mountains. And at that point, I was became part of the in German, the German Alpine Club had this program, which called Expedition Team. Like, yeah, it's like this young alpine mentoring thing, and I become a member of that team. So that was where I saw the first time the profession mountain guide, because before I climbed with my father, and then I learned by myself with friends, with people a little bit more experienced, but I never kind of had a guide who teach me something. So this was the first time I discovered there is a profession called mountain guide, and it was kind of, wow, that could be something nice for me. And originally I wanted to start studying after this 1 year of social work, but then I discovered this profession mountain guide, and I said, well, I want to try this. And then I was also like, oh no. And now after a year outside of Munich, out of the city, back to the city and going to university, was kind of, oh no, I think I can't do that anymore. I was so already so like, oh, I love this out here. So and that's when I decided, okay, I start now the mountain guide education thing. It takes 3 years or 3.5 years. And after that, I saw that the professional mountain guide is something really just, yeah, it's so enjoyable. So I can't think of something better at the moment as one of my two kind of income. So one is the mountain guide profession, the other one is like professional athlete or mountaineer, how you ever want to call it. So yeah, I never had then this in my mind then to do like a kind of normal job, and now to imagine going to an office 9 to 5
Open an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's the most scary thing you can give me. It's like my nightmares are out of this.
How important has the social side been to your progress as an alpinist? Like doing it, discovering it with your friends, or do you think it would have been the same even if you would have done it all like on your own?
No, for sure not. And I definitely wouldn't call me like a lonesome cowboy out there, I'm not a solo climber as well. So I really enjoy and also need, I think, in a way, to at least have like one partner. Like, I like really small teams, but 1, 2, or 3, that's like the perfect size for me on these trips and expeditions. And then to enjoy it together is something, yeah, it's part for me of why I'm doing it. And I love to spend the time waiting in a base camp with a good team, and you just have way more time to talk about everything, and everybody's way more, yeah, kind of, you know, relaxed and not distracted from the noise always around us here in the city
with the Wi-Fi
with everything. And nowadays you have Wi-Fi in the base camp, which is, I enjoy it on the one side. On the other side, I think, wow, another thing we have there now too. But yeah, I had climbing partners, which I went 2 months on expedition, and we almost had no contact than here in the normal at home in Wyoming. But every third year we went on, second year we went on expedition together again and again, and it was perfect. So I really, it's a huge part of being out there, that you have this social relationships and the network there.
But do you have relationships or friendships like that, what you just described? Like some people you spend time with, like when you're in the city, when you're in Munich, and some people you only spend time with out on expedition, out on the mountains, and you never go to like dinner parties with them or whatever, but you have certain friends that you only share this experience with.
Yeah. Definitely. I have friends who just, mostly because then they are no mountaineers, so I only see them when I'm at home, like old school friends, and still we have a super good contact. And every time I'm in Munich, we go out for dinner and doing these things. And other friends, I have, like you said, I only be with them on expedition, and we text maybe once a year or something like that, just to like, are you okay? Okay, good, fine. And that's it. And then suddenly, hey, next year, what do you think? We're doing this? Okay, we're doing. And then we go 2 months, 3 months on an expedition. Incredible intense from the kind of, you know, space you have to spend together. But it works perfectly. And it's, I don't need then the time in between to have kind of a, you know, ongoing interaction with this person, or that I keep being updated what he's doing, like a weekly thing or whatever. So it's totally fine.
But is it important for you to kind of keep these separate parts of your life, to kind of distinguish, well, these are friends that I share these moments with up in the mountains, but I can't spend too much time with them because maybe then it will, you know,
no, you
like to strike
no,
some kind
I,
of balance.
No, I don't think it's because of that. I think it's more just because often it's
they live
totally somewhere else. You also don't want. I mean, I have. You know, I want to spend also time with other friends, and often then you think like, oh well, I've been with this person now 2 months on expedition, now it's okay not to spend now again all the time with this person. So it's then I want to climb with other people. So I love to have different climbing partners here and there, and so it's more this location and related that they're not then all the time. So it's not that I think I need to have a break from this person because then it just works better in the end. No, that's
how would you describe the friendships that you create and the friendships that you make out on the mountains, like the people that you first, maybe you meet them at mountain huts and or camps and so on. How would you describe these type of friendships that you make?
I think it's a really intense friendship, and it's a very pure friendship as well, or you get to know people way better and way more without this facade, are you saying? Facade, which you easily can keep here in an environment where you are totally in your kind of comfort zone. So out there, even we are professionals, but we are dealing with situations where you can't, you know, put on this. It would take too much energy. You need your energy just for what's out there. You can't pretend to be weak or strong or whatever you want to be here in the city. And that's why I think this you get to know persons way, in a way purer and natural, more natural sense and kind. So, and that in the end makes, I think, a relationship which, or a friendship which works in this environment is stronger more intense in the end.
How would you describe the role of the mountain guide from your perspective?
Oh, it's a long question. Oh, yeah, because for me, the guiding I really enjoy. Still, I enjoy it, but it has something completely different to the climbing and mountaineering I do as a private person. So when I go on expedition for myself, it's completely different. When I go in Chamonix climbing a mountain for me with a friend, looking for my challenge, it's completely different. When I go with clients guiding, I get my satisfaction and my kind of joy out of helping this person to reach something which the person probably without me couldn't achieve. So then to see, for example, that I summit with him then, or with her, with a person, with a client, Mont Blanc, which is via like the normal route is something I've done a lot of times, and it's kind of, you think like, oh, it's super boring. But when you get to this challenge that you have to have, or like really try to, you know, make it happen for this person that he arrived there, it's a huge challenge. And then to see his emotion or her emotion being up there on the summit of Mont Blanc, starting to cry the same way like I cry on a Makalu summit on an 8,000 meter peak, for example, it's, I totally can relate and exactly knew what it feels like in this moment. And that gives me then to be a small part, or maybe a huge part of why he feels this thing now. It's a super good moment, and it's a very satisfying thing. So that what I really love on guiding and then guiding can be, yeah, so much. So that's why the question is really difficult to like answer with one with yeah. one question.
But is it also kind of a way for you to kind of rediscover your own progress and like get a different perspective of where you came from and your journey towards what you are today? Because you can kind of maybe see everything like from a fresh perspective, like from their perspective. Like you said, you've summited Mont Blanc hundreds of times maybe, but then again, doing it together with the client, you do you get some kind of
Well, it's I have one project where I really see this. It's I was now for 6 years the coach of this young Alpine mentoring program in the German Alpine Club, and there I totally see that, and this was incredibly intense, and it was really also stressful because you have to push these young persons there. They are 16 to 25, something around that, and you have to push them in an environment which, like a small mistake, and you can't always kind of, you know, hold them the right moment. So you need to kind of, you know, give them the long line, and they can and push them in this really environment, this Alpine environment where a mistake can be really pretty bad. And but there to see how they progress and evolve in this, it's always a 3-year program, so I did two of the teams, and it was amazing to see. And it was also for my, it was so motivating, it was a huge motivation for me always to go with them and to kind of see how they become stronger, and if I can keep the pace more or less. And for example, in rock climbing, they are so good nowadays that I don't climb as good as rock at A. But then when we come to altitude, it kind of, okay, I have it under control. And so, and but to see how they progress is amazing, and it just reminds me of how I was. And then on the other guiding things, it's hard to see this point. But there are other things then which is we're absolutely, which I enjoy and are good.
When it comes to mountains, what does a mountain need to have for you to become interested in it?
I think it has to have a story, and a story can be just the shape. The story can be that there's no story so far, or the story can be that they made history. Like I really enjoyed climbing the Eiger North Face, the via the classic route, because like every pitch, every meter you gain, you find a different place, which is like, wow, here happened this, and then you continue and like come around the next corner, and wow, here's this kind of bivy place, and this is called the difficult crag and whatever, and you know all the stories. So it's super interesting as well, even if it's nowadays maybe not the like the it's not super technical difficult anymore in the way what today alpinists can do. So yeah, there has to be a story in all the different ways, like I said.
Do you have a certain favorite mountain that you always come back to?
No, I don't think there's a really favorite mountain I come back to. I just love Chamonix so much, and because it has this, it's I think one of the best playgrounds I know for mountaineering. But there, I don't know, there are like the so many kind of different and smaller places and summits there. So, and I enjoy strolling around there and don't have like a particular one, which is like, oh, this is like my home mountain. And as I also kind of move so much around in my life, it's not that I always have this one mountain behind my house, which I don't know, a Reinhold Messner had when he always went up and down, up and down. I don't know, a Heidi Kreutzkofel or whatever.
When it comes to expeditions, are there different aspects of the expedition that you how does it work when you because I guess you get very a couple of times a year you get offered and you get presented to different kind of expeditions that would you like to participate in this or would you like to come with us and do that. What do you look at in an expedition for you to, this is interesting, I want to join this?
It's a good question, because really at the moment I struggle always to, I'm because there are so many interesting projects out there, and at the moment it's always like, oh damn, this is also like the, like I already have signed for this kind of thing, which is great, but then, oh, but this I would also like to do, and then, oh, and my girlfriend's like, hey, come on, you can't go back on expedition. And it's like, yeah, I know that as well. And so there are so many good things out there. So you need to come at one point where you say, okay, now the next 2 years I do this and this and this, whatever that comes up. And I know that I can't be everywhere. Like now I just stepped back from Nanga Parbat in winter for a second time. And I it was really hard for me. And I to make this decision, but on the other hand, I knew I'd just been back from Kyrgyzstan now for 4 weeks there on expedition, and now just spending here 1 month or 1.5 and going again 2 months on expedition Nanga Parbat, and then again in spring already another big expedition I have in mind, is just too much. So can't do everything. So yeah, I need to, and then how I choose the ones is, I don't know, it's of course they are all for me super interesting, I would like to do way more than I do, but in the end it's the time we don't have, and the ones that I choose is because it's maybe a new climbing partner which I kind of always, we planned long time to climb together, or some I don't know, some mountain which I always want to go. And so it's like, again, what we said, the goal has a story, and I can always tell you, I go to this mountain because this and this is the attempting part, or this is why I want to go there. So I would never go, and I also don't want to go if I don't have, you know, a feeling that one part of an expedition starts from the route, the mountain itself, the team or whatever, doesn't fit like 100%, or where I don't have a good kind of gut feeling that, okay, that is right.
And when it comes to the members of an expedition, because I guess you quite often end up with, maybe you don't know everyone on the team, what parts of, what type of personalities do you prefer, and what different aspects of the people, of the individuals, are important for you?
I mean, it's really very important, and I learned also in this direction a lot, and I had expedition where I went with really good friends, but we went together for the wrong objective, for the wrong goal, so we just had no... We didn't make it because, yeah, we were just the wrong team. Even we were good friends and we had no fights or whatever, but we just weren't the one for the perfect one for the objective for this kind of route. So you need to choose very carefully, and as it is such a long time where you are so in this limited space intensely together, it has to be a perfect setup, And because the smallest thing can drive you mad. If you with someone who have, I don't know, in the end it drives you how he eats his soup or whatever, or how he, you know, in the morning prepares his muesli, and you think like, oh yeah, if you do this always this loud way or whatever, and it drives you nuts. So it's a small thing, so it's, you know, and it has to be really perfect. So I really normally I know the people I go with, and so it never happened that I end up with on an expedition then in my team with people I hardly know. I had it now the first time in spring. I have to say that I really just knew this person via Skype, and it was also, I had from the beginning a good feeling because he was friend with a lot of my friends, so I know the kind of friends who know him, so this is how it worked then, and we had
one of the team
was very well, yeah.
But I mean, I guess in some way it's like a marriage. I mean, after a while, even though it starts with love, but in the end you can start getting annoyed at the small things, and
exactly.
Sometimes it, have you had like friendships like almost ending, or like you like after a trip or an expedition you kind of, well, we will take separate ways from now on?
No, not that we have it ended, but you had often the feeling that now you need a break from this person for sure, like, and that's what I had, but not that I never, luckily until now, had, yeah, like that we fight on an expedition and then we had to go separate ways or whatever. It was, I mean, it was often that one of my partners, they were like the first time doing an altitude expedition or whatever, and they discovered for them then that, no, really, it's not my kind of thing. I don't like that kind of style. But it was not because of me, because just, I don't know, they couldn't deal well with altitude, or they don't like this kind of environment there. So that's why we ended up never going on expedition.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, but not because of personally dislike.
Is there a competitive side of this kind of alpinism, like when you, like maybe you set out an objective, and it could be like one, it could be 2 years ahead in time, like a new route or a new peak, or do this peak in winter time, but at the same time, maybe there's a guy up over in the US or in Poland, like who's planning the exact same thing, you know what I mean? Is there a competitive side?
For sure, there is a competitive side in the way that, yeah, like you said, there are some mountains out there with, like Nanga Parbat in winter, for example.
Because it has never been summited in the wintertime yet.
Yeah, no, we have 2 8,000-meter pieces, K2 in Nanga Parbat, who have never been summited in winter, and that's what a lot of climbers at the moment try, and so you won't be there alone. Maybe could take K2, yes, because it's really, I don't know if that happens ever. So, but Nanga Parbat, a lot of people try the year, winter after winter. So you won't be there alone. And And you have to accept that the same happens to lines on other mountains, or could even 7 or 6 thousand meter peaks, where when we're really very attractive lines are still not climbed, and you know, okay, people will go there in the next years. That's why we often, it's kind of, I always don't like it in a way that you kind of don't talk about your upcoming expeditions or things. But on the other hand, you always kind of think like, if I say it now, maybe somebody else will. So you wait kind of the period that you think, okay, now they can't, you know, decide now, okay, I go now on a 2 months expedition, because it's just not, it's impossible just to say, okay, now I'm 2 months off. So now for spring, I have something in my mind, and we just, you know, don't talk about it in the way that we go there, and we're so until maybe, like New Year or whatever. So, and then.
But do you think that sometimes in certain situations, certain scenarios, that could be that could maybe perhaps add to the danger of this life, the competitive side? Do you think that some expedition they might stress a bit, that they might hurry and they embark on something that they're not fully prepared for, just to be first?
It happened in history-wise, definitely it happened when we just look to who's the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks without oxygen, when Messner had the competition there going on, and that happened. So nowadays, I think, I just can say it for myself, how I discovered it. I don't have then, once I decide I go there, I don't have the feeling I pushed harder or whatever just to be the first on something. And the same way which I never had the feeling to be pushed by sponsors, for example, or by some, some media that they want me to be now the one on the summit, or that they kind of, you know, they waited for that. And no, I don't feel there any pressure. And even, and when I look again to Nanga Parbat in winter, there was a Polish team with us, and the same route, the same time, and we worked incredibly good together. I never had this kind of collaboration with two teams on a mountain, and summer on 8,000 meter peaks, where you're also mostly not alone. It's kind of everybody do his own thing, because anyway, it was then mostly not any new routes or something like where you can be the first. It's just like you want to summit or not, and everybody does his own thing. And then in winter, it was, we worked so well together. We shared the weather forecast, we shared dinners, we shared tactics on the mountains.
Because you ended up following the Polish team, or one of the Polish climbers, because Simone got sick or something?
Yeah, and in the end, it was exactly like that Simone turned around and came too because he got sick, and I continued and joined Tomek, like the leader of the Polish team, and he was up there alone too because all his partners didn't came up as well. So we had radios and we said, yeah, we joined. So I joined him in camp 3, we continued to camp 4, we continued higher, and then we had to turn around because of bad weather, or the weather forecast was just for 24 hours good and we wouldn't make it in that time. So it was a great experience, and I said this, but even the better experience was how we were so open about when we go, how our tactics would be. So there was no playing kind of, you know, naughty games and this we do now, and then they think maybe we start and then we are the first on the summit. Because journalists and media, they ask us what would be our tactic to be first on the summit in front of their Polish team, and we just sit there together, laughed and read this interview request, and then just said like, oh my god, it can't be. So it was really, really a good experience there.
I'm guessing that at the level you are today, I guess that you ended up like working with people that you maybe looked up to and people you admired, like when you were younger.
Yeah, of course. Sometimes I kind of have this kind of, foolish smile that I think like, oh cool, now this person called me and asked me to join him for the next expedition. And I always read, or even the beginning of my career, I kind of read of these persons. And also now, for example, when I was in Langtang for this summit series thing, the first time I was 2 weeks together there on an expedition with Konrad Anker. And I mean, he was, you always read the stories of Konrad Anker, and suddenly you sit there in a lodge in winter in Langtang in Nepal, and it's totally normal, and it's...
What does it make you feel?
This makes me sometimes, like this kind of puts me a smile in my face, and I think, cool, and how it ended up, but it's not that I would think like, oh cool, I made it now. Now I'm in the, I don't know, first league of the mountaineers or whatever. So not at all. So it's just, I think I have more of the feeling like sometimes it's funny how the life kind of,
twists and turns
and then flows you to this direction and where you end up in a way. So that's what is a curious way of how it goes.
In 10 years, you'll be sitting in a camp with someone younger than you, and then he or she will experience the same thing. Well, here I am with
maybe
with David.
Yeah. I mean, it was, for example, so cool to see how Gerlinde. I was climbing with Gerlinde Kaltenbrunner a lot. Was with her on expedition, and she's the first. She's from Austria, and she's the first woman who summited all 14,000-meter peaks without oxygen. And she was, I mean, we were, when we started climbing together in 2003, she was, little known. But then, of course, when she finished, she was a superstar more or less in the scene, and Austria goes crazy to her. And it happened that I don't know if you still, or the former Austrian president, they call in base camp and make congratulations, and you pick up the thing and like, oh, I pass you. So, and it's super funny to see then.
Do you think it's possible to see any trends in when it comes to mountaineering and alpinism? And now I don't, I don't mean like the color of your jackets or style of jackets or clothes, but like, well, like now, for instance, the winter expeditions and.
Well, I think that, I mean, despite the color of the jackets, because there's a new tattoo, but I think the winter expedition, they're not a new trend, because it's just like, we are now on this final stage, and that's like where everything gets kind of concentrated to these two mountains, Nanga Parbat and K2. And before, I mean, it happened so long, and also Nanga Parbat would try in, 18 years or whatever. So it's not a new trend. The new thing is maybe that it's just way more easier to just get an audience for that and make it public through all the new media we have and the possibilities you have. But there's I think the one trend we see, which is kind of evolving more, or is pushing this mountaineering higher, is just this speed aspect. So all the equipment gets way lighter, and then there are mountaineers which are having a kind of different approach to mountaineering, and instead of like I BV that route out and spend like days on the face, they just have this radical approach of I reduce my equipment so much and be super fit as well that I can do it in one day. And there we see, I think, also on the high mountains, for new routes which are before kind of not possible because maybe you have no place where you can BB or with things like that. So there we will see, I think, like this is the evolution which at the moment happened, or the next thing.
What do you think, what is it that dictates these and moves these frontiers within alpinism? Is it like tech, like the now it's possible to make equipment that's so much lighter but still durable and strong? Is it like the tech part, or is it something else?
I think it's a combination. On the one side is the tech part, like we said before. I mean, when we see the equipment which they had, on the first ascent, it was just so heavy. But this, they had to have this warm jacket, which weighed, I don't know, 10 times more than we have now. So, and with this jacket, you can't be fast. So that's the one side. And the other side is that it gets more professional from a sport, yeah, as a sport itself. So the younger generations, they start now to train way harder, endurance and these things, way earlier than it was before. So before, when we go even further back, like to someone like Hillary or whatever, they were sportsmen, but they were not really, like, they were way more adventure in the classical thing. So, and now they are really professional athletes who train hard and come even more from a competition sport like endurance running or trail running, and then they convert into mountaineers, so then they become the adventurer, so, and not the other way around. So that's what I think is makes the change.
Because that was actually also an answer to my next question about if you see any new type of people that start out in this, but this, that would be my guess as well. Yeah. Like you said, like people go like trail running, the next step is like ski mountaineering, and then you're into alpinism maybe.
Yeah, exactly. This may one approach which you see many new talented, fast, good alpinists come up there, or they start as competition indoor climbers on plastic, so, and then they suddenly become super strong alpinists, like for example David Lama, or the other one from the trail running side is Akilia and Jornet, who, yeah. You know, so you have these types there, and these are not the only two, they're coming a lot more. So
was it more dangerous before, you think?
No, it was not more dangerous before, I would think. It stays the same, and we have now a way better safety margin due to better equipment. Of course, we push it also then again the limits. So I think it's the same, and nowadays maybe it becomes even more dangerous because this evolution, like people go from indoor climbing to outdoor scary climbing, it happens so fast because they have all the power, but they have the lack of knowledge and experience, which has to grow over years. So, and that is the danger, I think, which is nowadays way more than it was in the past.
If you guess, look in the crystal bowl, where do you think, like, if you will look 10 years ahead, what would you guess that the climate is like when it comes to alpinism? Where are the new borders, the new frontiers?
That's hard to say. I think we see one direction which goes that it's like that you can be as a consumer really 24 hours with such an climber out there through no new technologies, and you can put your VR, like a virtual reality clad goggles on, and you just be
put
with
it on
them.
Killian and then
yeah,
let him
put
run
it,
away.
Yeah, exactly. And one, while he's doing that, you can be with him, and there's not only one, there are like millions who summit with him, Everest or whatever. I think that will, I mean, and I don't think that Killian is the one who want to do that. I mean, don't take me wrong, but someone like King, and that's the one thing we will see. And on the other hand, we see the other extreme, that there will be really new, very strong and interesting people coming up. We totally refuse that kind of trend. So, but yeah, I think we will see scary things with this kind of, that you can be so close to when it happens. I mean, it already can be now. It's almost now possible, but still, it's kind of, you don't want that. But I think it won't take long that you can be really close to when it happened in real time.
The next question is very, very big and very vague. But if you see an expedition on the way to a summit and go down again, if you look at that risk equation, the entire equation of this exposure. How would you describe the danger, the factor in this, which is danger? How would you describe that and your relationship to it?
I don't know if I can get you right now, but I just answer and then you can correct me. So I think, I mean, danger is part of this game, and without the danger, it wouldn't be so attractive, and maybe I don't want it to do it. But it's not. It doesn't mean that I'm looking there for getting my thrill moments on an expedition. Exactly the opposite. I try to avoid them as much as possible. So I do whenever I can. Go not in a slope who looks avalanche or under a serac or under rockfall or whatever. So I try to make my best risk management possible to avoid any dangerous zones. But still I knew I it wouldn't be so intense and it wouldn't be give me so much back in the end if I would only go to mountains which are just a small hill and which don't challenge me at all. So, and the challenge in the end, maybe with some call it then danger or, yeah, it's hard to, I think, to describe it because if, as I said, I don't want me to call like a risks, kind of risky guy. I don't think I'm yeah, kind of, you know, looking for the thrill guy. So, I think it comes along and it's also super difficult to see for, or that I think I have a totally different kind of what is dangerous and what not, because I have the experience and I'm there in this place to someone who looks from outside and have not this experience. They often think, we have borderline syndrome or something like that. We just want to die, but it's not that, it's the opposite. And that's why I also think somebody like, I don't know, when Alexander Huber climbed Free Solo or something, or Hans-Jörg Auer climbed Free Solo, the fish or whatever, somebody who's not climbing, he thinks that's absolutely unverantwortlich in German. It's not responsible, like it is unresponsible?
Irresponsible
to do something like that. And for me, it's like, yeah, but they have thought about everything what they do there. So they have a really good risk management to what they do, and they said for them it's okay. And I think someone who goes, like, oh, I go this small hike here around Stockholm here in the forest, and he even don't know what dangers there are, and he has a way worse risk management than the guy who's doing a free solo on an 8,000-meter peak, I think. So it's really this kind of point from where you look, or where's you. Yeah, so the guy who's doing it, I think he's kind of aware of all the risks who are there.
Do you think if you look at the past, have you become better at keeping within your limitations and within your potential? Like now you know where you can push yourself and you know exactly what line where you can balance and. Back in the day, were you more, was it more possible for you to kind of exceed that? And maybe you didn't even know that this is way past my level, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I learned there to be aware at least, okay, this is now the point where I push really harder or outside of my limit now, or where I step outside of my normal, where I think, okay, now it's getting really here risky in a way, but I'm way more aware of it, and I realize, okay, that's now the point, and do I want to continue or not, and then I make the decision. So, and that was in the past, I think, Yeah, not that I was so conscious about where I am in my field of going over the edge or not.
If you look back on your climbing career, has it been difficult for you to turn around? Or have you always been good at that?
I think I learned it quite early that it's part of being a mountaineer, and especially doing expeditions, that turning around you have to accept. And it's even the moment up there feels horrible when you do it, and you kind of, you know, this card, how it is like collapsing at once. So you're just like, damn, it's so frustrating in this moment, but it's part of it. And I never, I think, turned around because just of being lazy or because of I don't want anymore. So it was, and then and that's why I think I'm a good turnaround, but I think it's something which is normal. When I look back to 99 was my first longer expedition trip abroad, here we are, and to Patagonia. From now, I just came back from my 31st expedition or something like this, in this 15 years or 16 years, and half of the expedition were successful in the way that I reached the summit, and the other half not. So if it's 50-50, which I think in every other investment you do, you would say, oh, we do something else. So, and I think if other alpinists look at their thing, it's pretty the same. So yeah, it's part of the game.
Have you ever made decisions up in the mountains that you afterwards that you are ashamed of, that you did it for the wrong reasons, that you made bad decisions, and that you, you know, felt ashamed of, like, well, this was really, really bad?
Yeah, I mean, one time only, I have to say. This was then pretty full on. It was on Amada Blam, the story we had there. So we climbed there, like a new route to the north face of Amada Blam, together with a friend of Japan, from Japan, Kasuya Hiraide. And we ended up on a ridge, and there we kind of got stuck, so we couldn't get back and forwards. And we also were so light that we couldn't repel the whole route. And our strategy, and this was something we knew from the beginning, and now if it's we have the time here to make it long, I think. So
yeah, for me,
so we thought about when we started to climb in the lower part, if there the conditions are climbable, then we in the upper part they must improve, because there is sun hitting the face, so the snow gets better, and there's wind to make the snow conditions better. And we did an acclimatization trip to a mountain like 2-3 kilometers close to that mountain, to Island Peak, and the same exposure of the ridge, and there it was really good at the same altitude. And we started the climb, and it was good to climb, so we knew, okay, we want to go to the top and then back down the other side where our fixed ropes and where the normal way go down. This was the plan. And then we climbed there 3 days to the north face, and then we got to that ridge, and there we got stuck because there the conditions were so bad that it was not climbable anymore. So it was only avalanches going down wherever you stepped on. It was huge pinnacles, seracs, which was not climbable. We wanted to go down, and the ridge, which was the same way down, so we had only one kind of protection thing for in this snow, and so we were stuck. So we called the rescue, and they came immediately, and they took me, because they took only one because of from the weight of the helicopter which can take, and they took me, flew me down, and then they flew up again. And then by the second attempt, where they went to rescue my friend, the helicopter, the rotor touched the ridge and fell down 1,800 meters, and the helicopter crew died, so the pilot and the rescue guy. And Kasuya was not in the helicopter at that moment, he was just like half a meter away, so he was alone there. And then the next day, the best friend of the helicopter pilot of Captain Sabin came then with the last helicopter in Nepal and rescued Kasuya. So it was pretty full-on story. And come back to the question, this is like the only chapter in my mountaineering career where I really kind of ashamed of that we ended up in a situation where we needed to be rescued without having kind of an injury. So we brought ourselves in a situation where we got stuck. So that is something which is, I have to accept this as part of my career, or not career, but of my life as a mountaineer. But, and I can't change it anymore, unfortunately. And I'm ashamed of it, but yeah, I have to accept it.
But you looked up that you went to the families of the helicopter crew, and you have contact, or you had or have contact with them.
Yeah, that's then. I mean, the whole story then brings continues until now, and became to something really good and so positive in the way that I have a really good relationship with the family of Purna Avale, was a rescue guy who died there. And at the moment I try to manage, or we try that their son, Rikesh, that he goes to Germany to study there. So I just got yesterday that he has the visa and all these things. So it's really cool. So what happens, how this changed, and the relationship to both of the families are really good, and also like when we went after this accident to the families when they had the funeral, was such a crazy intense experience and situations and feelings which I never had before, and that is really positive, but just the beginning, of course, of this friendship. And this story is like the darkest point in my, or the darkest moment in my climbing.
But you never had a, it never made you consider like leaving all of this behind you and kind of not to do expeditions?
No, not at all. I mean, of course, the moment it happened and I was down and he was up there, Kazuya was up and I was down, and I kind of realized that this helicopter crashed, and I was totally destroyed in a way that I was angry about everything, you know, the mountain, the climbing and all these things, because this kind of, what can we do and why this need to happen, and it's not fair from everything. And but in the end you realize it's not the mountains who made us go. I mean, we go there, so and we want to go there, and up there Kazuya, he took a picture on this evening when he was alone there, and I was up and he showed it me afterwards, and it's one of the beautiful sunsets you can imagine. And you watch this picture and immediately you think, wow, I want to go climb this mountain there and this there. So we both continued, and we both had never, I think, the moment that we think we want to stop it. And also the mother of Captain Sabin, of the one, the pilot who died, it was really very intense. She looked at me when I went to the funeral, and she said to me, David, you need now to take really care, because you need now to live the life of three. So it's like, and you should enjoy life, and that's what I'm doing. So I think I couldn't do any better at the moment to do what I do, to do, go to the mountains. So I think I kind of fulfill what she wished.
What is your what I usually call like reactor look like your inner core, like this thing within you that generates energy for you to keep going when it's like dark, cold, and you're tired, and you're like your entire body screams at you to stop? What keeps you moving forward? Where do you summon energy for that?
I think from all the positive moments I had, and how they felt, and that I know that I have to go through this kind of dark moments or these struggles and these moments where you feel weak and where you want to turn around. And once you get through these moments, the other side feels even better. So I think once you experience that, you want to have it again and again, and that was what drives me forward.
You also work as a photographer or a cameraman?
Yeah, but only on expedition, and this is more in the meantime, because it just changes slightly that I can be out there more, that really like a professional athlete. And so for me, it's something I really enjoy and like to do it. So I would call it meantime even more like a hobby. But of course, even on Nanga Parbat, I was doing the pictures and was paid for doing the pictures and things like that. So I think it's an okay level, but I wouldn't call me like a professional photographer, because that wouldn't do all the others.
What are you most proud of?
I mean, the one thing is really I'm kind of proud is how this chapter of Armada Blam, this accident, turned out now. So where it is now, and if I really, when Rikesh be able to study here, this would be one of really my really proud moments. And then the other thing is just, I think I'm just, yeah, that I managed until now, yeah, not to lost any toe, any finger, so that I turned around always at the right point, as it seems. So, and still have, yeah, summited quite a lot of the mountains.
Is it possible to say at what stage you are now in your life?
I think that's difficult to say where I am, because I dream of so many things, so I wouldn't say that I'm now on my high. I mean, definitely I don't think I'm at the high point of where I want to be for myself. So no, there, I mean, I started now the first time to work with a coach to train, so really like super concentrated
and like a mental coach,
it's like physical mostly, so it's really to get like on another level of endurance and physical strength. So, and that I'm really curious and interested to see what I'm able to do when I train with him for, I don't know, 6 months or whatever. So we will see. So I definitely think I hope I'm not on my peak.
Thank you so much for taking your time.
You're welcome.
My name is Kalle Ringborg. I work with marketing and events at Nature. First time we heard about this The Other Way project or summit series project was 1 year before the release. But first time we saw it was in Fredrikshafen last summer. We were invited to this show where they showed us the product and told us the story about it. After that, we had 30 minutes to place an order, and we went for it. Super cool project, really nice stuff. And we were the only retailer online that was allowed to sell it in Sweden. I think the whole release was a really cool idea, that everything was top secret until the date when they released it. We had a really cool lecture with David Göttler in one of our shops. And I think the whole package was really cool and really fun project to work with.
Follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle Husky Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.